Hello and welcome to the Rise Up Radio.
Bonsoir et bienvenue au Rise Up Radio.
Yeah. You're talking about Rise Up Radio.
It's incredibly important that people resist what is being done in their name, resist and actually try and change the world.
I think that kind of physical obstruction of BNP activity is very important.
He's been in the hold of the front of the main screen off. Two lock on right in the middle of the main road.
Rise up for radio.
Hello there, welcome to Rise Up Radio.
Dobre veci, dobre došli, Rise Up Radio.
Je voudrais deux croissants et Rise Up Radio, s'il vous plaît.
Nottingham!
Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio.
Do you have a minute?
Yeah.
Could you tell us what you think about the world today?
I think the government need a kick up the arse. They all need sacking and get some normal public who know what they're doing and sit them in a room and let them run things, because the government haven't got a clue what they're doing. I think if people got together, because they will have enough in a few years' time, and put the foot down, then they could make a change.
Do you think there's broad popular support for today's system of government?
No. No. But people don't know any better. That's the trouble. So I suppose it's a case of kind of informing people and informing yourself as well. If it all fell down, it wouldn't really matter to people generally, you know, because it's all unreal, you know. It's all based on credit. So it'd be better if it just collapsed.
Who are you?
I'm a volunteer. I work with a local community-based radio station project called Rise Up Radio, and I'm just asking people.
You need to pay me. I don't do free.
What do you think this says about society?
I don't do free interviews.
It's all about money.
Yes.
Do you think we live in exciting times here?
I'm more worrying at the moment. More worrying than exciting. For me personally, I'm not in work at the moment, and I'm pregnant, so no one wants to employ me. So I'm in a bit of an awkward situation. Anarchy. I think of Sex Pistols.
Do you think there's an anarchism movement that's alive today?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I think most people's against what the government's doing. As soon as the government makes any decision that's in line with what America's doing, then most people I speak to are like, well, can't be arsed with that. And I think that in elitist, you know, you look at the government and people, and they've all come from like public schooling. They've all known, they're all pally with each other when they're growing up in school and then at uni.
Do you think it could ever get to a point where people get so pissed off that they actually decide that they want things to be different?
I'd love that, but I don't know whether everyone's got the energy. I think there's maybe not enough faith in to think that one person can make a difference and can G up their mates to say, look, we have a voice.
Hi, I'm Captain Paul Watson, and you're listening to Rise Up Radio.
I think I'm preaching to the preach, to be honest here.
Fantastic. That was our outside reporter, Jacques. Talking to the people on the streets in Nottingham. That was some anarchy on the streets. Okay, well, I'm Ginger, and you're listening to the Nottingham edition of Rise Up Radio.
And I'm Dom.
Hello, I'm Tin Man.
And I'm Sophie.
I'm Jack.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Crust.
Hi, I'm Tony.
I'm Will.
Hi, I'm Eva.
And thanks to Sarah for some lovely elevator music to get us going. And I think we're going to get straight into the show with some live music from a Nottingham performer called My Crust.
There's a girl at the party back home. There's always a girl. Hair, a lips bound, and the smile surrounds everything. Everything. Talking today, I feel like wasting away. I feel like slipping down, heading out of town. And the lips that melt on my skin, and my heart, as she's running back to her daddy's car. He's thinking away back home. I won't see her for another year. For another year.
Okay, now is an interview with Sophia Mason, who's been involved in the anti-racism campaign at the university, trying to get rid of Craig Cox, the education officer who wants to bring back slavery. Okay, well, for once I'm not actually near the campaign stall, but I'm here with someone who's very much a part of this campaign and the Free Hish campaign and most campaigns that go on in the student area and some beyond. And with Sophia, you're involved in this one. Do you want to give us a quick sort of rundown of why this one is so important to get involved in?
There's lots of different reasons. I mean, what I've been saying to students when I've been talking to them about the campaign is that historically unions have developed in order to protect people from racism and from other forms of discrimination. And so how are we going to stand by while somebody, an education officer, somebody responsible for representing our queries or our problems with our course, how are we going to stand by when an education officer holds up a sign saying bring back slavery, refuses to apologise, goes to the Daily Mail, refers to the legitimate investigation into the complaints made about his conduct as a witch hunt, as a show trial that would make Stalin blush. I mean, this is really sort of, this is hyperbole. This is just reactionary opinions coming from somebody who's a young Tory. He wants to be an MP for the Conservative Party and is using RSU as a step in his career path. And it's like, are we going to let him use us in that way whilst he holds these sort of what I consider to be abhorrent views? Or are we going to fight back and reclaim, in a way, reclaim our union? I mean, it might be a bit beyond that. It is a bit bureaucratic. And I've found through this campaign that it's quite hard to sort of get a sort of direct democratic sort of line of communication. You know, it's quite complex, two-thirds majority and such number of voting council members. What I'm talking about here is how we've tried to get a vote of no confidence motion passed in order to get him removed, and that's come across as quite complex. But so maybe reclaiming the union is going to be difficult, but you know, just reclaiming the university in the sense of making it known that we are not going to put up with racist attitudes on campus. I think that's what it is for me. It's the same reason I got involved in the Hish campaign. It's to stand up and say, we are not going to stand by whilst innocent Muslims are arrested. We are not going to stand by whilst young Tories say bring back slavery, whether it's a joke or a mistake, as he claims. I don't care. You know, we're just not going to let it stand. So it's about reclaiming, in order to answer your question, it's about reclaiming the university as a place to fight against racism and also holding the union to account. You know, you're supposed to be protecting us from these attitudes, not, you know, having them yourselves.
The last couple of days we've seen leaflets coming from the other side of the argument. I've already spoken to one lad who isn't part of the Craig Cocting but has doubts about the Say No to Slavery people or Say No to Racism, because he says it's not racist. In fact, we're only saying it's racist because it was a white person saying it, and slavery isn't purely about black people. Any response to that at all?
Yeah, definitely quite a few responses you can make to something so ludicrous. Firstly, it's very common for right-wing people to try and reverse the truth, right? To put it simply. So what's happened is a white person has made a racially motivated held up a sign with a racially motivated statement on it. And what they're now doing is saying, oh, you're only saying this because he's white. You know, the whole politically correctness gone mad argument they often use. So that's the first thing to be aware of, is that this is common for them to try and turn things around and completely reverse the facts. That's number one. Number two, slavery did happen in many civilizations across the world. However, the wealth of Europe and America, just as the two most obvious examples of parts of the world, is a direct result of the wealth gained through the exploitation of African slaves during the transatlantic slave trade. Britain having its sugar plantations in Jamaica and numerous other Caribbean islands, Spain having Cuba as a sugar producing nation, and the United States having the whole southern states with these slave plantations. That use of slavery for sort of from the 1600s until the 1800s, 400 years use of slave labour has enabled these countries to develop in the way that they have. So to deny that this is about the transatlantic slave trade involving African slaves is to deny that massive part of history that has had such an integral part in the development of, you know, globalisation and currently sort of neoliberalism, etc. And these massive divisions between rich parts of the world and poor parts of the world can be traced directly back, in my opinion, to this period, to the slave trade. And the reason why, to get back very specifically to this point of saying, oh, it's not racist to say bring back slavery, all of my black friends, members of the African diaspora, Caribbean students, African students, international students at this university are offended by what he said as black people. So it is not up to somebody else to say, oh, this isn't racist. If black people have taken it as a racially motivated statement and are upset about it, then it is. And it's not up for anyone else to say that it's not.
I'm loath to bring this up, but it was mentioned by the other person I've interviewed, so I figured it'd be best to give some kind of response to that. He brought up a lot of the time inherited victimhood of the black student body here. They're living in a post-racial times, so why should they be so upset about these things?
Inherited victimhood is a strange way of trying to deny the reality of racism today. We have a large number of black people dying in police custody still, the number, the last I heard was around 1,000 since the 1970s in this country alone, black people murdered by police. In my area, black people are constantly harassed at tube stations, at bus stops, by police, often with sniffer dogs. They're stopped and searched, sometimes several times a day. If they drive, they're pulled over all the time. These are just the most obvious forms of racism that you can see when you're in an area with a large black population. But there's these other types of racism that are more subtle, such as the fact that black people are more likely to be unemployed, the fact that black students are most likely to sort of face some sort of racist treatment at school. These forms of institutionalised racism, which, quite frankly, people who make the kind of statements you outlined in the question are simply not aware of. And I would like to give them the benefit of the doubt and just say that it's not that they're being horrible, it's just that they don't know, as they're not black, and so how do they know what it's like to grow up as a black person in Britain? They don't, quite frankly. Inherited victimhood is not what's happening here. What's happening here is black people are articulating their anger at being quite obviously discriminated against. Sometimes obviously, sometimes more subtly in British society.
Well, you spoke about outside of the university, trying to bring it back into the university because that's where this has taken place. Obviously there's two big protests going on. One's about a Muslim guy, one's about a white guy. University protects the white guy, not so much the Muslim guy. No, a hint of institutional racism is in the university. But do you think Craig Cox, as stupid as he was and as offensive as he was, almost did a favour because he's brought about a dialogue about race within the university which wasn't there before or wasn't there as heavily before?
This is true. I mean, if he gets removed, retrospectively, I'll look back and say, you know, wonderful chance to build a massive campaign and to, like I was saying in the interview earlier, to create a space on campus. Right, so while we're flyering, while we're getting signatures, while we're explaining to everybody who passes us what happened, what we're doing is we're creating a sort of almost physical space in which it's clear that there are a number of students who are against racism. You see, and I think that has a knock-on effect. And I think that the vast majority of students at this university, without wanting to generalise, are apathetic. A middle class are white and are apathetic. And I think that they can very easily be swayed in the face of what they see, what they deem to be quite a sort of popular student campaign. So I do think it comes down a lot to ignorance. I think there's very few hardcore racists who actually, you know, would vote for the BNP and really want to repatriate the black population and absolutely have a hatred of black people. I don't think it's as obvious as that. I think they've never actually known any black people, so what their attitudes towards black people are informed by racist stereotypes. The cliche is from the media, but it's true. You know, if you only see black people in the way they're represented on the television, you are going to develop these sorts of negative stereotypes, and that will affect how you interact or how you respond, for example, to an incident such as this. If you've been told, oh, black people can get very angry, they've got a chip on their shoulder, which is what a lot of people say, but if that's what you've been told, then when you see a campaign being built up around something like this, you're going to already sort of try to frame it within what you sort of think you know about black people. So I think it is definitely ignorance. Space for perhaps a bit of hope comes from the fact that there are large cities, for example, there are white people who have grown up with so many people from different races that I think in that sense integration sort of undermines racism at its very core, because you can see the stereotypes aren't true because you know black people and you know they're not like how the media portray them all. It's clear that there is racism, it's clear that there's institutionalised racism coming from the university, but I do think there's sort of some space for hope, and I don't think that it's a sort of the kind of racism we would have seen 20 or 50 years ago, you know?
Okay, let's stick with the campaign itself, and you've mentioned lots of people sort of running up, wanting to join in or wanting to support. The actual campaign are from fairly disparate political backgrounds and political beliefs. Mm. That must be at least somewhat encouraging.
Yeah, definitely.
How's it been for you? I know I was at the first meeting as well, where there was a lot of call for leadership, which perhaps doesn't settle that well with you, and nor with me, but eventually people seem to take control and take responsibility without needing that leadership.
That's exactly what happened, yeah. It was an interesting meeting. Everyone was extremely angry with what Cox had done and the way he responded afterwards. And so some people did start to say, what we need is a really strong leader, and directed some of those comments towards me because I've been suggesting that we just need to build a sort of non-hierarchical campaign and that these can be very successful. And I gave some examples of anti-deportation campaigns I've been involved in that don't have strong leaders but that do achieve wonderful things. when we started to say, well, actually, we can set up a stall, or we'll print some model, and when we just started to organise, the same people who have been calling for leaders just stopped saying that and started saying instead, oh, I'll write the press release. Oh, you know, literally, the exact same people just stopped saying that and started just getting involved. My only problem, and this is not with the Say No to Racism campaign only, this is with every campaign I've ever been involved in that I can think of off the top of my head, is that there's very clear gender divisions in terms of who chairs is always male, and who takes minutes and writes up emails and this kind of thing is always female. But this is just generally across every campaign I've ever known, so it's not a personal, it's not an attack on this particular campaign, it's just something I've mentioned to the people involved.
I'll be sure not to edit that bit out.
Okay, and now we're going to go straight to a track called Cinderella by a Nottingham band called Oh Lovely Lie.
Shortly after I interviewed Sophia, I interviewed a young man from Italy who's making a film about the Free Hish campaign, and this is him talking to me in the university.
So my name is Francesco Ragazzi. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm also an aspiring academic, as a PhD student in Sciences Po in Paris. I'm currently based in London. I work at SOAS as a research fellow in the politics department. So the way I heard about the campaign is through my academic links with, in particular, I received an email from Vanessa Pupovac, who teaches here at Nottingham University. My friends and I usually work in group for the films. We're looking for different stories concerning the question of balancing liberty and security in Europe and the current debate about privacy versus security measures. So we thought that Hisham's story was actually quite a good example of the problematic aspects of increasing security measures.
Okay, for myself and for the listeners, could you sort of draw the dots or draw the lines to the dots between Hish, the topic she's just talking about, and how it affects other people?
Our point of departure was to ask ourselves, with stories like Hisham, for example, or there are other stories taking place in Italy, in Belgium, in France, almost every EU country has a similar story or stories. Would this have been possible 10 years ago? And most probably it wouldn't. It would have not. Most of the terrorism laws have been passed recently, or the sort of intrusiveness of these laws has been increased in the recent years. And therefore, we wanted to sort of document and inquire on the different changes that have taken place in let's say the past 10 years, more or less since September 11, regarding our personal freedom and our personal liberties. And the guess is that there has been much change, but we don't know. We actually, the general public really doesn't know what has systematically changed, what has been pushed, and how the limits of our civil liberties are sort of reduced in the name of more security.
So that was almost your like original hypothesis that there have been changes and they're going on now. During the filming, have you come up? Is that hypothesis changed? Have you learned things that you weren't expecting to, and been taken in directions that you weren't originally planning to?
Mm-hmm. Well, we are at the very early stage of the film, so we're still sort of collecting documentation and reading also academic books and articles. And obviously, there seems to be a trend in this direction, but we want to speak with MPs, lawyers, security agency officers, and ask them what is actually really going on. And I think it's through these witnesses, through these different accounts, and connecting them through the personal history, the personal story that Hisham is actually going through, that we will get a full picture of what is going on.
So for those people who think that this might just be a propaganda film on behalf of Hish, it's not really the case at all. You're being critical of everything that you touch, as well.
Yeah. I don't think this should be a propaganda film. I don't think it should be a film only looking at Hisham's side, because it would eventually deserve not help him, or not help anything that is surrounding to this campaign. Obviously, we're not going to hide that we are sympathetic with Hish and everything that he's going through. But we really want to look at all the aspects of the question and sort of let it to the viewer to decide what his opinion is. And I think people are smart enough to understand arguments from both sides and make up their own mind.
Okay. There's going to be a showing of what you've done so far of this film, or is it another film you've done in the past that's showing tonight?
So, from what I understood, tonight there's a showing of the two previous films that I've done with my other colleagues. So one is the first film we did on the question of suburbs in Paris, the suburbs that then were the theater of the riots. Mm-hmm. So this documentary is about a Turkish community in one of these suburbs. The second film is based in Italy and is exploring the paradox, or the apparent paradox, that Italians used to be an emigration people and now are facing a big wave of immigration. But basically, in 50 years' time, they forgot that they were on the other end of the migration chain. And so through this, we want to explore what happens and how the problem of migration and racism is actually taking place in Italy. So I think the easiest thing that people do when they go to Italy and they are asking their sons about civil liberties, and broadly, if you are on the left side of the political spectrum, you will tend to look at political parties like Lega Nord or Alleanza Nazionale. Alleanza Nazionale is a post-fascist political party, pretty much like the Popular Party in Spain. Lega Nord, the autonomist political group, is now increasingly anti-Islamic and xenophobic in general. So these are the easy targets, actually. What I think is more interesting to see, and what is less covered, is that parties on the left, and particularly the in Bologna, the mayor of Bologna, who used to be in the Communist Party, is probably the mayor who has enforced the biggest number of restrictive measures in terms of civil liberties, in terms of surveillance, cameras, control, etc. So what I think, what I would urge anyone who comes to Italy to look at, is to see how the reduction of liberties and the increasing culture of surveillance and control is really widespread in different areas of the political spectrum, and especially I think it's worrying to see these kind of tendencies on the left. But obviously, if you're in Britain, you are not very surprised by this kind of things.
That one last question is, how can people who can't make it to the showing tonight, how can they see your films?
Okay, for people who cannot come here tonight, our film is, you can buy the DVD online if you want, or you can go to the website of our film, which is www.mericadoc.org. So, America, MERICADOC.org.
Okay, well, brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. And
okay, thank you very much.
Okay, and we're going to have some footage now from Green's Windmill audio footage. We've got three interviews. A couple of our reporters went down to the Urban Harvest Festival, which is a celebration of the harvest in the city, and it's been organised by Transition Nottingham, and this was on the 5th of October, and we'll go over and listen to it now.
How's it going?
I think it's going superbly well, actually. At 10 o'clock this morning, everybody's thinking it won't stop raining. And now what's the time? It's about 3 o'clock. And look at it, sun's streaming down, people are streaming through the gates, and a lot of awareness about transition and the problems that we are facing are being raised, but in a very positive way. So I think it's going superbly well.
Okay, so describe a few things that are going on today and
yeah, we have the very popular apple press. Everybody bringing their apples and turning them into apple juice. Barter tables going extremely well, where people can swap very large marrows for even larger marrows. We have an activity zone with face painting and also weaving stuff out of rubbish, which is really ace. We've got an award-winning butcher over there, Johnny the Butcher, I call him. He supplies Michelin star chef Sat Baines, and he's award-winning sausages and burgers. But to complement that, the other side, we've got the Harvest Cafe, which are vegan. You know, so you're catered for everybody. We've also got all sorts of things, information zone over there. So we've got how to compost your waste. We've got the transition stall, which tells you about transition and the transition processes and where you can join your local group. And we've also got eco teams, which have a look at street by street and local, again, a grassroots activist group. So, yeah, all in all. And, of course, the fantastic mill itself, which is... What can I say? I mean, look, it's the star of the show. Beautiful with all its bunting going around in the sunshine.
Could you just maybe say just a little bit about what transition is for you? Why did you get involved in this?
I got involved in transition because it's not a crusade. I've never been involved with any green groups because it all gets a bit boring after a while. But what I'm interested in is looking at problems and looking for solutions to the problems rather than just highlighting the problem. And what we're facing an uncertain climate. We're certainly facing resource depletion throughout the world. It's not just oil, it's all sorts of minerals. We're facing topsoil depletion. We're facing all sorts of problems at the moment, and this is getting people together and saying we can do something about it. And that is why I got involved in Transition, because we can do something about this on a local level, and what we do local will reflect globally.
Are you part of a local group
We're trying to get together Transition Mapley. That's where I live. We're joining with Sherwood, because they're our next door neighbours. So it's getting a buzz together there. But at the moment, I've been doing an awful lot of work on the steering hub, the steering group for Transition Nottingham.
And what about St Anne's? That also borders Mapley. St Anne's is an area that's poorer than both Mapley and Sherwood, but it borders both of those areas. So what about Transition St Anne's?
There is a Transition St Anne's, and they're grouping together with Snenton. And I would like to see that happening, because to be honest with you, it's areas like that which really need to get that community spirit back together again. You look at places like St Anne's, they've got problems, you know. You look at St Anne's, you think, oh my God, you're going to get stabbed to death when you walk through there, you know. It's that type of thought about it. And I think...
Do you think that's perception or reality?
Yeah, I think it's perception. Because I know a lot of people in there, and they're lovely people, you know. They've got, but that's the problem. It's the perception of it, and I think to get a really good, strong transition movement in Stanton and St Anne's would be a very good thing to happen. And I'd be quite happy to do that. But what I don't want to do is yet another white middle class liberal come down from the hill and tell people everybody's got problems at the moment, a white middle class liberal come down and tell them how to run their lives. Yeah, it's just wrong. Yeah, it needs to come from them as well. So hopefully we've had some people from St Anne's, I hope so, because I leafleted around there the other day to get people here to see what they can do and how we can work all together.
Hiya, can you just tell us what it is that you do?
Yes, my name's David Bent and I'm the miller here. And I'm responsible for running the mill and making the flour and looking after it.
How do you mill flour?
Well, you've got a windmill to help you. Basically, you put the grain through two millstones. What comes out, if you're lucky, is flour.
And where do the sails come in?
They provide the motive power. They take the power of the wind, turn it into motion, and the machinery drives the stones, and you get flour.
So this is a working windmill here in Nottingham?
It is, yes. It's one of the very few. There's about four or five in the whole country that are actually commercially run, and there's about another 20 or 30 that run at kind of weekends for the tourist trade.
And is this windmill commercially viable? Is it subsidised?
It's subsidised. It's actually owned and run by the City Council as part of the museum's service. But we try to mill every bit of flour we can and sell it to the public.
So where are you getting your grain from at the moment?
Our normal supplier is a man called Joe Bradley, who has a farm called Hungry Lane Farm at Sutton Bonington.
I've heard in the press that up to a fifth of this year's wheat crops have been spoilt by poor weather conditions. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, we should have a type of wheat here called spelt, and it's like going to be 3 to 4 weeks before we get any more of it from this year's harvest. Joe was telling me that his crop of rye, he had to stop harvesting it because it was so damp it was clogging up the combine harvester. So they went and did something else. And when they actually came back, they found it actually sprouted in the ears, so they couldn't combine that at all. Got a field of rye and it's gone.
And that's because of wet conditions this year?
Because of wet conditions, they couldn't get it off the field and dry it before it started to grow again. You know, the seeds in the actual ear.
I mean, do you think this is just a one-off bad year, or do you think there are sort of implications to do with changes in the climate that are going to continue to happen and cause, you know, unusual weather?
I honestly don't know. In the mid-90s, we were having heat waves and droughts and things, and now we're having at least two wet summers. So, I mean, maybe two or three years' time, I might have an opinion, but, you know, I don't know. I think the climate can be fairly variable.
All right, so how's the wind doing today? Is it a kind of good level? Or?
It was, when it was raining, it was quite slow. Then the sun came out and it picked up and it was really doing well. We actually managed a 25 kilo sack in 45 minutes, which is almost up to par, but now the wind's died away again.
You know, I'm sitting here with Elsa, who I met earlier at her delicious vegan cake stand, and what are you doing now, and why aren't you at your cake stand?
Well, I've just finished up, I've just sold up all my cakes, and I quickly went and bartered around for stuff, which was fantastic. Then I got my face painted by Fabrizio, who is incredible, and now I'm here with Claire Ball, the Recycle Queen, and I'm making a bowl out of plastic bits and cardboard, and I think they look fantastic.
I'm sorry, well, I must say you look fabulous.
I'm loving it. Striking. It's the best face painting I think I've ever had.
Oh, so your cakes are vegan. What do you think about a transition Nottingham event having a butcher's?
I was quite surprised by it. Very taken back. The butcher's come and bought some of my cake. And I said, unfortunately, we can't do it the other way around because I can't eat any of his produce. He says my cakes are amazing, the vegan cakes, so I'm really happy with that. And we had a big discussion about what he does, and he says he does have a vegetarian Barbie. And lots of people have asked him today, but he didn't brought the meat down because he said, the organisers said that there would be punters here who would also buy meat, and he didn't want to stand on anyone's toes. I'm not quite sure that's good enough, though. It's a really difficult one to answer because I don't really know why he's here, but I know he's a wicked guy and he sources things locally, and he seems to be his head screwed on as well about vegetarianism. He seems to know his stuff. He's just come from a background where butchers in his trade and is in his family. But he's done a lot of vegan events, he's told me. Yeah, and he's done cooking demonstrations with vegans as well. So he is actually, as a guy, he's a quite an interesting character. He's up for a lot of stuff, which is good. So as a person, that's fantastic.
What do you think about not just him as a butcher, but like transition Nottingham or transition towns in general and their relationship with meat?
Well, it's just not sustainable, is it? So if we're talking about a more sustainable future, then we've got to cut back meat so massively. And I mean, I obviously don't really miss eating meat. I was a really big meat eater for years, and since I had my first veggie sausage sandwich at the Sumac, haven't gone back.
Ooh. Thank you very much, Elsa, and I'm going to let you get back to this amazing looking bowl.
Are you going to help?
Yeah, why not?
Right, let's go back to Mike Crust, who's going to play us another song from the studio.
Then TV, staring into the box, wasting away till your brain has seen better days. Wilting, rosemary's hanging over the sides, close to death, but water has brought new shoots. Close to the base, bright green but too short to cut. Still alive, growing again until I forget your water again. Then wilting, hanging over the sides, till you look so sad, I can ignore you no more.
Hot off the press, yeah?
Hot off the press indeed, Ginger.
So
that was completed about an hour ago.
Well remembered. Remembered all the words and everything. It's good job we've got no TV on in here, all sitting looking into the roaring open fire.
Yeah, feeling wide awake and my brain's going pretty well.
Excellent. Well, I don't know if you're going to give us another song a bit later.
I hope
so. Okay, yeah, good, yeah. Good. Well, we're all just wondering whether there'll still be bits of wood to burn when the crisis hits in. Yeah, well, we've got a little bit of a new feature beginning with Resident Hillary, who's going to be talking a little bit about the economy and the imminent crash and how to prepare yourselves. I don't know if any of you guys in the audience have been worrying or thinking about how these things are going to affect you, or have you got a little word to say here, madam?
I was just wondering where the crash was.
Read about it every day, but it's not quite arrived yet, has it? Maybe we won't even notice.
Just because of where I live, I can notice it because all the shops are closing down and the community centre, my local community centre, seems to be closing down as well. And I still go down there every day, down to my local sort of high street down the road in St Anne's, but there's hardly anything left. You know, there's a few people around, but most, I think. Yeah, the Chase, but I think that sort of, just I don't know, normal people seem to be outnumbered by CPOs and CPSOs and but that, yeah. But yeah, it seems a little bit bleak down there, so I guess that is kind of maybe how I see my local community slightly being affected by things, but I don't know, like, if there's a direct relationship or not. I don't know, but it does feel like there's a little bit of a sort of depression going on in my local area.
How do you think people in your local area are gonna take it? Like, if their shops are shutting, do you think they're just gonna kind of go indoors and lock down, or are they gonna try and do something to tackle it?
I don't know, because I don't feel that I've not really like built up a lot of relationships in my local community, and I've tried to do that, so I don't really know a lot of people yet, and I think it is actually hard for sort of people to form relationships with their neighbours these days, but I'm sort of trying to do that by kind of volunteering. Like, I'm going to volunteer at the Chase Centre, which has no paid staff anymore, and see if I can make connections with people that way and find out more about how people are going to manage, because I really don't know, because if there aren't shops there, then I don't, you know, maybe people go into other places to buy stuff, but I don't know if people can afford stuff. I know there's...
They go into big supermarkets, don't they?
I think I went down to Asda the other day, and everyone's there. Everyone is hoarded into the commercial spaces. And I think that with a crash, what's happening is all the smaller bits and pieces of the economy, the ones which are locally grown and the ones which individuals sort of decide they need to set up because there's a need for something, are all getting just monopolised very quickly. And it's been happening for 10 years, slowly, but with a crash what happens is the majority of wealth gets concentrated to the big centres of production and the distribution centres. And basically what's happening is these big warehouses are being built to feed millions of people.
But do you think if people aren't going to pay for it, they're still going to feed those people?
I think they'll just have the power to ration people by then.
Well, don't you think that is it Lehman Brothers? Like, things are crashing. Like the big things. Like, I feel like I don't have any savings. I don't have things like me as a little person. Maybe it's not going to affect me. Potentially, I don't know. Whereas like big business, maybe Asda, Walmart is too big to be affected, but I think maybe they're the people who are going to feel the most losses. Maybe they can afford the losses.
Wait, is it losses or is it just a drop in profits? That's the thing.
That's true. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to be able to afford to keep... Their only stranglehold is their low prices, and if there's only so... People are only going to be able to work so much, grow so much, crops failing and things across the world. There isn't the supplies of things to we're quite lucky around here. We get a lot of homegrown food. A lot of people have allotments. A lot of been a lot of nice pumpkins around at the moment. There's been lots of apples. It's been apple season galore. You know, we've done quite well. We're still kind of reasonably self-sufficient.
I think reasonably self-sufficient, but I think there's still quite a long way to go in terms of providing food for ourselves, like, to be realistic. But I'm just sort of noticing that as well, that as I've, you know, personally got less money, that it's more difficult to make up the rest of what, you know, what you can't grow from other sources if you're short on money. So,
but this is, I mean, like, what we're talking about here is all, it's that feels a bit doom and gloom. I can feel myself going, oh, I want to go to bed now. But do you think maybe positive things can come out of this? Like, for example, if people do realise that their local community centre is going to shut and they start working together to keep open. I mean, do you think positive things could come out of this crisis?
I mean, not everyone feels the same. You know, a lot of people are just perfectly happy and positive, and they're working and they're affluent, and they don't notice any kind of changes really. So it's but I don't know what the proportions are of people who are adversely affected already and who are feeling the pinch.
I think in the absence of an economy which works, people really do need to start doing stuff for themselves and meet people and work out how a community can work more efficiently and, like, in a system where we don't have as many resources. But, and I think people can, but the problem is, like Mike was singing about, is the telly, and that's the way that we can...
I think that's just a very small part of a very big problem.
Yeah, maybe. But I think, well, no.
I don't know, if you wiped out the TVs, you'd be making progress.
It's the hypnosis of...
That's true.
Yeah, it's hypnotism, which... you can pull out of, and I tried to pull out of, and lots of people tried to pull out of.
You don't miss it if the television's gone. Like, that's the biggest fear. Like, when you're living somewhere that doesn't have a television, you don't even notice that you're not watching television.
Maybe this is the key, the, like, strategic key, is to wipe out all TV.
Anyway, who needs TV when you've got Rise Up Radio? Like we said earlier, our roving reporter, Hillary, has been out talking to people about this, and I think he's making a Rise Up Radio feature. I think he's got a little bit of something to say about that. So let's just listen to Hillary.
Okay, for the last few weeks, I've been trying to put together some audio work in relation to the current economic crisis. And what we've done just now is we've made a page on the Rise Up Radio site. I think it's titled Looking Into the Crisis, trying to get together loads of different perspectives and to try and understand the economic situation from, like, the perspective of ordinary people, feeling that the news as they're covering it is not really showing it from the perspective of ordinary people and not making it comprehensible to ordinary people. Although, like, it certainly is a very complicated situation. I don't think it's impossible that we can understand what's going on around us at all. So that's the hope. So if anybody has any thoughts about the current economic situation, then please get in touch through the Rise Up Radio email address, or leave any comments on the page as well, and keep an eye open as more stuff goes up. So yeah, look forward to hearing from people.
So that was Hillary trailing his new Rise Up Radio show, which is called Looking Into the Crisis. So more doom and gloom there, but I'm sort of quite excited by it at the same time. The page for the audio for the Looking Into the Crisis project is at riseupradio.wordpress.com/looking-into-the-crisis. Yeah, get in touch if you've got any points of view on that situation. What's next?
I think Tin Man should let us know what letter this month's Rise Up Radio show is brought to us by.
As Eva well knows, it's brought by a letter P to signify the seasonal vegetable, the pumpkin.
But you were going to do your nice like Sesame Street voice.
I need a jingle. Can you do a Sesame Street style jingle?
No.
Oh, the sax! This is good.
Yeah.
Can we have a sax?
Yeah, let's have a sax jingle. This month's show is brought to you by the letter P for the pumpkin and pornography.
I'd just like to say that I'm actually feeling quite perky this evening. Other people may be thinking the tone's quite low, but I'm feeling pretty good. I'm not too worried about the pending economic crisis. I think it'll bring new exciting times, and we'll I think we're all going to figure out how to deal with it, and it's going to be an adventure.
Does anyone want to buy any porn?
I was living half a mile from your house. Still I didn't help your wife and your girl. Thought I knew what was going on inside. We'd pass in the street and we'd smile and we'd laugh and we'd talk. But still I didn't help your wife and your girl. Thought I knew what was going on inside. Should've cut your little fingers like you did to your little left-handed boy, so you couldn't sign the papers that said that the lady with the scalpel could cut your girl. Took a walk through the park, through the school, to the church with the graveyard where the girl lay dead. She bled and she bled, she bled and she bled, though she wasn't old enough to bleed from there yet. You say I can't criticize your culture, 'cause mine is messed up too. But a wrong and a wrong don't make a right, they make a wrong times too. The other night I went dancing with your wife. I bet you didn't know that, but you know it now. She's a poodle in a field, she ain't got no wheels. She's stuck to my heels and my heels are stuck to her. She's not going home with me tonight. She's not turning out the light. He says she's cut so she doesn't cheat, so it hurts to make love, even to him, even to me. What's to stop him from cheating? Has his dick been cut off too? I can help him if he wants. Sick and criticize your culture, 'cause mine is messed up too. But what's fidelity worth when fidelity's no choice? I was living half a mile from your house, but still I didn't help your wife and your girl. Thought I knew what was going on inside. We took a walk through the park, through the school, to the church with the graveyard where the girl lay dead. She bled and she bled, she bled and she bled, though she wasn't old enough to bleed from there yet. It's a nice happy song there.
You've got a dark side, Mike. Was that your collection that was found in a duffel bag in a service station?
It most definitely was not. Thank you, Ginger.
I have a pee, actually. I thought that last weekend I went to the Anarchist Book Fair in London, and a good pee that I learnt about was the Paris Commune. I, much to my shame, always thought like a commune was like a house, but turns out commune was the whole city. But it was exciting. But one of the things that I learnt at the pee Paris about the pee Paris Commune was the revolution actually happened while all the revolutionaries were in bed, and I thought that was really nice. They woke up, and in fact the people are just like this. The man giving the talk said that it was mainly the petty criminals and the scallies had taken the streets while the revolutionaries were in bed, and I just thought that was really encouraging. I thought, crisis, pah, it's all going to be good, pah, there's another P.
But weren't you saying yesterday that we shouldn't go out after dark in our own neighbourhoods because the scallies are about? Do you think the scallies have already started the revolution, maybe, and we're just scared of them?
I think quite possibly there is a chance.
Are you getting ready to play us one more?
What have we got left?
No, he's just fiddling. Well, we've got the Martin Luther King thing that we haven't even mentioned yet. Yeah, we were going to end on that. It's a piece that was recorded in Nottingham. Are we ready for that, or have we got anything else that we want to add?
I think we've ploughed through tonight's content.
We've ploughed through it. Plough, that's another P indeed.
Passionately.
Popping, pick it up. Popping firewood.
I think the revolution just exploded in
chuck
the
it in the fire
there.
Pick it up.
They played us a lovely tune earlier, but we're going to listen to another one from Oh Lovely Lie. Paris Commune was something that I got very excited about this weekend, but it turns out Will, who's sitting right here in the room, knows a little bit about it, so he's gonna, as you may have noticed, I didn't actually know that much about it. He's gonna tell us some more.
Well, I'm not gonna talk exactly about the Paris Commune. It was in 1871, and it was actually a direct process, a direct result, or a direct reaction to a process known as Haussmannization. which I'm going to tell you about. A guy called Baron Haussmann was given the responsibility of restructuring Paris according to a sort of economic, political and social vision. One of the main things that he was worried about was insurrection, and so he made the roads wider so that soldiers could be shipped in. He made all sorts of incursions into the architectural fabric of Paris to ensure that there would be no sort of insurrectionary activity. But the fact is, he created ghettos. He completely moved whole populations out of Paris, and he pissed off so many people that despite all of his attempts to stop insurrection, the result was the Paris Commune and complete insurrectionary, anarchist, revolutionary activity. So the point I wanted to make was that despite all attempts of the state to actually stop insurrectionary activity, they couldn't stop it. And that is a really sort of positive thing to take hold of, especially in this current climate.
And maybe that, in fact, by trying to design societies and the lay of the land so that people can't rise up, just added to it.
This may be a silly question, but this rise up, so why isn't Paris currently that commune?
It was the biggest massacre.
Yeah, it was violently suppressed about 3 months afterwards.
Where they lined up and shot over 30,000 people up against walls.
See, I think that's quite worrying. Like, I didn't know exactly like how it ended, but I knew it was something not particularly pleasant. A similar thing will happen.
Well,
here,
one of the things,
maybe a similar thing to follow it.
One of the things, as far as I understand it, though, that happened in Paris was it was just Paris. It wasn't the rest of the country. But it's one thing. There are lots of things to take on board. I think it's dangerous, but these things are dangerous. But I don't think that means that it's worth not pursuing, because what happened in those 3 months that we haven't really talked about was really amazing, as I understand it. Like, different these ghettos that Will was talking about started running themselves and figuring out how to supply themselves with food and with other things, and built up networks amongst the different ghettos so that they could work together. And so Paris became one, and like the commune, as I understand it, was their council. So it's where they came together and they spoke about things, and they spoke about things like the abolition of marriage because of the way that women were treated within marriage, and the possibility of women working. There was lots of, and it, like Matt said, it was run on anarcho-communist principles, which meant that people were running themselves. They didn't do a run on the bank, though. But apparently they went to the bank, and the bank in France there'd been so many revolutions that they went, give us some money, and the bank just wrote them a check, so they didn't actually need to steal the money off the bank. The bank knew how to deal with it. I think the bank also had their own militia protecting the bank at that particular moment, although I think that has been a criticism of it, as I understand from reading about it on Wikipedia when I got home from the Anarchist Book Fair.
I mean, Eva, it is inspiring that people came onto the streets and did all that stuff and took hold of the means of production within the city and like worked out how to do it. But I guess the point that Mike was sort of making is like that didn't work, and I don't know if necessarily following an idea of like.
I'm not advocating using that as a model, but what I'm saying is one of the things that it shows is that an entire city can work together, can work under anarchist principles. Like, not as, like, yes, it was violently repressed, and yes, we have a state that if we try and resist it, as we've seen this summer at various things, will try and violently repress us. But what I think it does prove is, like, a lot of arguments against these things are like, yeah, but like humans just can't work like that, we need people to, you know, humans need people telling them what to do. And I think what it proves is that you don't.
Definitely proves that there's like lots of different ways of doing things, and I personally think that it shows that that's like a lot of the principles were really sound, a lot of people, the ways that people were organizing were really sound. That's stuff to learn from.
But just because it worked on a micro level doesn't mean it can't work on a macro. Potentially, it can work on a macro level.
Right.
I mean, like, you look at a city like Paris is massive. It's not global sized, but it's not the size of Forest Fields. Paris is a really big place, and they took the whole city, and I think like that could be reproduced. Look at nature. Look at the cauliflower. These things, you know, like, I don't see how it how it can't. I really think.
I think it just needs to be a different way.
I have a quote, and I'm just going to get it about revolution.
All right, this situation is obviously not exactly the same here now as it was then. So, you can't just predict that it will be exactly the same. But I do agree with Eva. It's worthy of awe. When I say awesome, worthy of awe that it happened. It really is. It is amazing example that people can work together. I'm really, really impressed by it. I don't have a but.
People work together all the time as well, and that I think just needs to be amplified.
On your thing of not following the Paris Commune as a model, I have a quote here, and I can't remember the quote's from, but it is: "So the revolutionary proletariat can never, without ceasing to be revolutionary, recognise itself in any past or any models." And I think that's really nice. In order to be revolutionary, you have to do something that's new, that's not been done before. Because, like you say, previous revolutions, we are where we are, and they've got us to where we are, and we still want to revolt and change. So, I think you can still learn from these things. It's just not to follow them as doctrines. You may laugh, but you know, we have this crisis. What, we're just going to sit back and you know, just like let the crisis weigh really, really heavy on us, or let all this staff.
And Rise Up means loads of things. It doesn't just mean take to the streets with tools. Well, or it means take to life with an idea that you want to make things happen.
I'm not talking about a violent, like, yeah, let's go down to County Hall and get John Collins and all these people. Like, is he called that? I don't even know. But anyway, I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying, like, we can resist, and you don't have to resist violently, but we can work together, and it's going to be great.
Okay, so that brilliantly ties in to a nice little end piece we've got for the show this month. As part of celebrations of Black History Month, and also in lots of work about the suffragette movement as well and how it affected people locally, there was some public speakers in the city square, and we've got a recording here of a section where a Nottingham man called Walter de Aguiar read Martin Luther King's famous speech to a full crowd at the City Square, to a lot of people, and a lot of people listened to this. And I think we're going to play it in full, because it's a really powerful piece, and it's something that you recognise a lot of the "I Have a Dream" quotes, and little bits of it get soundbited, but it's quite a long and powerful speech. So we're going to hear that now. This is Walter de Aguiar reading Martin Luther King's in City Square, Nottingham.
Are we on? Some of you may remember this speech written by Martin Luther King Jr. I'm going to attempt to do the great man some justice by reading his speech for you today. I am happy to be with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. 50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives in an only island in poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself an exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men and white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of just of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as our citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check. A check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy. Now is the time to make real. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of this moment, this sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. And those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The world winds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of this nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But there is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, has come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny, and that they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied as long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodgings in the motels of the highways and the hotels of our cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the basic Negro mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We cannot be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating "for whites only." We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and the Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied and will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day, on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day, right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white girls and white boys as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain and the crooked places will be straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all men shall, all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, let every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that. Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and city, we will be able to proceed to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." Thank you.
I've been Eva, you've been listening to Rise Up Radio, and I hope you enjoy November.
I've been Ginger, and I've been sharing pizzas this evening, which I found in a bin. Lovely.
I've been Tin Man, and the best thing I shared this month was a flatbed electric vehicle with 20 of my best mates.
I've been Jax.
I've been Matt, and the best thing I shared was some music with some really lovely musicians last night. It was great.
Hi, I've been Will, and I'm very much looking forward to Conkers tomorrow.
I've been Mike Rust, and the best thing I've shared this month is probably a live fire warming my toes with some lovely friends.
Lots of sharing with lots of lovely people. From Rise Up Radio for November, goodbye.